Welcome to Linux Link Radio by TimeSys, the podcast for embedded Linux developers who want to simplify and speed up their custom platform development. Visit TimeSys.com today for access to our podcast archives.
Welcome back. This is Maciej here. I'm in our little studio in Pittsburgh with Gene.
Oh, hi there.
Last week, we've covered the one of the events, Embedded Systems Conference East in Boston. But prior to that podcast, we were talking about various different tools that you can play with when you perform different functions on your embedded Linux system. Today, we're going to continue on that topic, and we'll cover a number of debugging techniques or concepts around debugging.
Yeah, and I also want to talk about the tools involved as well. There's a couple of techniques, and some of them are really, I think, misunderstood by some folks that are new to embedded Linux or even have been around embedded Linux for a while. So I figure we'll take some time and clear the air for some of those things as well.
Yep. Let's start with the big one, right? Which in case of Linux is a GNU Linux debugger.
Oh yeah, for all intents and purposes, that's the default debugger that's out there. It's interesting, right? The GNU project is separate from completely separate from GDB, project wise, and it has been one of the other, the second largest GNU project out there in terms of people that use the tool for development. GDB started out as actually a fairly simple debugger, and has been expanded to take care of multiple languages, multiple platforms.
Yeah, I remember the first days when it was just performing simple functions and was not coupled. Well, at that time, the systems were not as complex as they are today. Right?
Yeah.
Today, you got multi-core processes.
Sure.
You got so many new mechanisms in both operating system and that people code at the application level.
Yeah, and people expect a lot more asynchronicity. I don't know if that's a word or not, but people do expect a lot more asynchronicity out of their debugger. And GDB is, I wouldn't say it's there yet, but it's moving that direction and it's doing a great job. And that's really important when you get into multi-threaded, yes, but definitely, most certainly, multi-core systems. The GNU debugger is actually making, that's really tough to say, it's really making strides towards covering that use case a lot better.
Right. And well, in the initial days, it was covering only some languages, some development languages.
Yeah.
But today, the coverage is pretty wide. It supports C, definitely C++.
Oh, yeah.
It also can debug programs written in Pascal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it supports also Fortran.
Almost certainly Fortran. And Objective-C, too.
Objective-C.
Yeah.
And there's, I think, Ada as well on the list.
Oh, wow. Does anyone still program in Ada?
Well, I think that there are still some projects.
I know that's off the beaten path, but I don't... You know, that's... it's really interesting because for a while, maybe a couple of years ago, there was a spike in, R traffic for people asking about Ada cross-compilers for, I think, PowerPC boards or whatever else.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, gee, that's interesting if you get the compiler, but what in the world are you going to do for a debugger, right? Because, right?
No, Ada is actually a very nice language, right? It's got all of those definitions that are very useful when you want to control better your application, programming from a real-time standpoint, for example.
Well, I'm sorry.
That was a segue,
I guess. But a lot of that, too, is, and a lot of that language support really is based upon the debugging format that's used. I don't know if a lot of people actually dig in, but the typical file format produced on a Linux system is in what they call an ELF format, which I forget what that's even stands for. I think it's executable linking format. I don't like acronyms unless I can unpack them. So, and that has its little complement as I think the guys had a sense of humor called a dwarf. Officially, I don't think a dwarf stands for anything officially other than to make fun of ELF. And that's where the that's where a lot of the debug information resides.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the system can get in there and debug multiple languages and multiple, not really multiple platforms, but that's definitely how it can get in there and describe multiple languages.
Structures.
Yeah, because Dwarf is actually fairly language agnostic. Mm-hmm. You build up some associations between where things are in memory and its lines and, a bunch of other, I think they call it die records.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Die records.
Yeah, die. But anyway, if you really want to dig in, there's a couple tools out there for reading die files, for reading out the die records.
Mm-hmm.
There's like a dwarf dump or something that'll dump that stuff out to you.
Helper applications that can allow you to analyze some of the data included in those files.
Yeah. Well, I don't mean to get too off the track because I know we want to talk about, debugging in the kernel, whatever else, but I just want to spend maybe a minute or two to talk about the magic that makes that happen. Because it really is a testament to software engineering that you're able to devise both a system and a debugger that's able to debug, you know, arbitrary source code. Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, there's a huge amount of difference between C++ and, you know, Pascal and Fortran, and have that information stored in such a way that that one debugging tool can read that and do a great job of debugging the program, really, as a
Absolutely, because cool when stuff. You look at the application written in C++ that tend to be fairly complex today, and you really start the debug process from very baseline level, from addresses and references or some numbers, right? And you have to translate it back upwards to a specific location in a file, which is usually associated with either class implementation or some sort of function. So taking that information that you get from the target and then abstracting that back to the specific line number in a code, in a C++ code, that's a lot of work that the debugger has to do, and a lot of semantics and complexity inside the debugger to get that information upwards.
All the complexity that C++ introduces with, you know, the scoping rules and this inheritance rules and those templates where you can code some bugs you'll never find, I swear. It's very, very difficult work.
Yeah. So GDB is a console-based application, right? So you don't have by default any front-end graphical interface. You have console, and it's a command line-based tool that you control by issuing or entering into a specific subsystem, GDB subsystem, and then operating or controlling it with other commands.
Well, you know, a lot of people out there, I guess it's depending. I know that when we sat down before, we said, well, we want to talk about the kernel debugging. So I'm just going to say it again, but I mean, a lot of folks actually prefer the command GDB. And I guess I'm exposing my gooiness, right? But it's not... I mean, it's interesting for a small program, but I've never really found it satisfying for something halfway decent size. Mm-hmm. Since we have a lot of people, they'll dig in and they'll get DDD, you know, 3Ds, the data display debugger.
Yeah,
I guess what it's called. And that's really the grandfather of front ends for GDB. And it's wonderfully flexible. And as soon as you get your head around how it divides a screen whenever you do watches, and it puts that panel up on the top, as soon as you get your head around how that works, it's wonderfully productive.
It's a really great front end. I mean, if you have a fairly simple application or something written in C, and let's say it's got a very limited number of threads, using GDB at the command line is not really a problem. And engineers that spend most of their careers developing code using command line, that's the preferred approach.
Yeah.
However, once you move to very complex applications where you have, well, I don't want to say hundreds, but tens of threads running that your application starts, and you want to be able to efficiently switch between the thread context and analyze threads specific stacks. It's just you know, that friendliness, that ability to save you time by not having to type in a lot of commands to do a simple task, right?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, for me, the tipping point is, you know, you sit in command line, you type B space and then the symbol name in order to set a breakpoint. So that even though it has tab completion, right, it depends on me remembering the symbol name. And I know it sounds really lame, but I can't remember. But then again, if you want to set a line on a breakpoint on a certain line too, you have to code that in by hand, and it's a line in a file. And if you're writing anything that's semi-complex, right, it's going to have, you know, again, hundreds of files, and so that gets really difficult in order for you to set. So that's why a lot of people gravitate towards the front ends, because it does make manipulating your breakpoints and your watch points substantially. Well, it makes it manageable, in my opinion. It really does make it something you are able to do.
I agree. And one aspect of that, why people, especially in embedded space, tend to move to graphical interfaces, is the fact that you cross debugging. I mean, you're on a target platform, and you are running your application on a target platform while operating the GDB on your host.
Yeah.
So we can talk about this a bit more. But
let's talk about Kernel. I'm sorry, we got off.
Actually still spend a few more minutes on GDB, because I wanted to mention what you can do with GDB. We talked about that it supports different languages, that it's got different formats that that can support internally. But end users can use GDB to track registers at any given point in time, right? You can take a look at various memory locations.
Sure.
You can place breakpoints, as you said, right, and control the execution between the breakpoints. So there are those different commands like step in, step out, step over, which are well,
essential,
the operations that you want to have at hand with any debugger.
Yeah. Well, it also has watch points built in as well. So you can hang around and say, hey, whenever something changes, do something, hit a break, and then you can set up some pass counts for that as well. Mm-hmm. So if you've ended up, you know, coding yourself a nasty little problem, and you know that, you know, variable foo hits, you know, 5 and variable bar hits 8, and whenever that happens, you know, cause a breakpoint because something squirrely happens thereafter, mm-hmm. you can get things set up so you can do debugging without having to, you know, hit that continue button 14 times as you watch 7 variables change until things get in the right condition. Right? Yep. 'Cause, I mean, that's half of doing debugging is setting things up so you can get right to the problem, opposed to attempting to run things in a random mode.
So absolutely. And what else you can do with GDB is you can attach to a running thread.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the modes in which GDB can be used, because mm-hmm. there are a couple of them, right? Mm-hmm. There's one where you start a GDB at the beginning of when you start your application, and then you just walk through the execution by running from mm-hmm. a breakpoint mm-hmm. to a breakpoint. Mm-hmm. There is the second approach where you can attach GDB to already running thread.
Yes.
Right. So that's very useful if at any point in time you want to see if your application is still performing well, or you want to take a look at a number assigned to a specific variable. If that mm-hmm. variable is a counter of some sort, right? You want to see if that gets reset periodically as expected. Mm-hmm.
Or there's other times. I mean, my classic case for doing that is whenever I'm convinced the debugger is somehow interfering with my debugging session, mm-hmm. right? Because whenever you get into anything that involves multiple threads of execution, that sort of things, the debugger itself can have a mm-hmm. great effect on how the ordering problems, but or the order in which things run. And if you have a race condition, the debugger itself will either introduce or suppress the race condition.
Yeah.
And the frustrating thing is when it actually suppresses your race condition, because then makes it harder to harder to find and harder to bug.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. I mean, that's one of the great things for attach.
So the third aspect that I wanted to mention is that you can take a look at what went wrong with a specific program after the crash occurred. So let's talk about that. Yeah, because this is actually that moves also to a kernel land where you can analyze the kernel core dumps. But every application, when it crashes, it can generate a core dump, mm-hmm. Which is really a state of memory, or really a contents of memory stored into a single text file.
Yeah.
And with GDB, you can load that same executable on your host machine, along with the core dump, the map of the environment in which application was executing at the time when it crashed, mm-hmm. and you can pinpoint a problem inside your application without having physically access to the target.
Does it show you the line that it faults on?
I think so. Yeah, you can trace it back to specific section of code inside the application where the fault occurred.
Yeah, so it'll have the equivalent of BT, right? Yeah. So you can see at least what the stack is. Mm. Whatever. So that's really cool. I imagine for the kernel, that's nearly an essential tool.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I know we want to talk a little bit about, and this is probably your forte more than mine, but we want to talk about kernel debugging. Because there's a flavor. I mean, using the core file is a great way to do postmortem debugging.
Well, so before we jump to kernel debugging, I wanted to quickly close on GDB.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. But just wanted to bring up another aspect of GDB, which is very useful in cross-debugging, which is a GDB server. And why people tend to use a GDB server, right? Or why GDB server is so useful. And one very big argument is mm-hmm. that to include GDB on the target root file system, you have to have at least 2.5 megabytes of storage.
Oh, yeah.
And it takes a lot of space and memory. It's if you do a native debugging on a target, that's usually fairly slow. So to support a cross-debugging, there's another aspect of GDB called a GDB server, which is really a kind of like a daemon that runs on a target.
Yeah.
But the value here is that it's only 40 kilobytes.
Yeah.
Right. So it's very easy to include that in any root file system. Even if you're constrained with a footprint, you can still include the GDB server and have that access to the target.
Yeah. Well, it's important, I guess, at this point to mention GDB server has, of course, it's like a stub, we'll call it a stub program, right? So it's a stub program that runs on the remote host, and then it needs some sort of communication protocol mm-hmm. to talk back to the
actual GDB.
Yeah, talk to the where you're doing the debugging. So in that case, it has, it can use a serial line, mm-hmm. Most people choose to use the network connection.
Right.
And the GDB protocol itself is weighty, as I was describing, because there's a lot of data that needs to go back and forth between the two.
Yeah.
So if you're using a serial line, even if it's a fast, making quotes with my fingers, you know, as fast as a fast serial line can be, it's still rather slow compared to the amount of data that needs to be shipped back and forth in order to get a successful debugging session.
Yeah. And another great aspect of having GDB on a target is that...
Oh, you mean GDB server?
GDB server, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Thanks.
No, that's okay.
Is that... application on the target can be stripped out of symbols, and it doesn't need to include debugging symbols in the executable, right? So if you space constrained, you can still have your application stripped down to a smallest possible size.
Yeah.
And by having a GDB server on the target, you can always attach to that application.
But you mean on the host though, on your development host, that's where the symbols reside.
Exactly.
And you can load the symbols from that file.
So the requirements would be such that on a host machine, you have precisely the same application in executable format with all the debugging symbols and all the necessary information embedded in it. So. Yeah. For debugging purposes, that's ideal, right? Because if you have a requirement to have a small footprint application in a field, but you want to still be able to see what's going on when you know you see some signs of wrongdoing by application, then it's fairly easy to connect and check it out. I mean, there might be some security challenges here. Because once you have a daemon listening on a specific port,
you're open for something.
You're open for something, but that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah. Well, you know what? The other thing too is if you find yourself in that environment, one word of warning from someone who's done it themselves, right? At least at the very beginning, don't set yourself for like O3 optimization.
Yeah.
Because yes, you might have something on the board, and yes, it might be as tiny as it can be, but holy cow, it's probably undebuggable with the optimizations that happen. I'm not saying in all cases, but whenever you use the high optimizations, it does enough code reordering that the association between line of program, right, and source line and output is different enough that single stepping through something really won't be that helpful. But you can debug on like a function by function basis, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when I found myself in those sort of pickles, I usually end up setting my breakpoint, right, to the end of the function,
right? Stop, right?
Because what happens is it has to return there because somewhere in the great mystery of whatever the it's all that loop unrolling and all that other fancy computer science stuff, right? That it's no use trying to single step through. You can't, and so you set your debugger for the return, and just watch and see what happened afterwards and try to fish out the problems. I mean, if anything else, it's probably one defense for the. If you started out doing Pascal, a lot of people have, you can admit it.
Well, it was one of my first languages.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that sort of beat into you is that you can only have one exit point, right? Out of your, the language itself, I think, forced you to have one exit point unless you use that, Turbo Pascal variant. I think that snuck in that. Yeah. But if you get it set up with one exit point and you do that by habit, it makes your life a lot easier when debugging because at least you have one exit point, you can check.
You know where to. Yeah. Eventually place a breakpoint and stop the debugger and then take a look at the state of your environment.
Yeah, and then fish around. I guess one thing I did want to mention is in the distant early warning department thing is there's an interesting project because it's coming out. It's on Google Code or whatever. It's called Chronicle. Mm-hmm. This is actually pretty cool. It hooks onto Valgrind, which we talked about I learned how to pronounce it correct. I was saying it wrong this whole time.
Cool.
And it hooks onto Valgrind and it works as a recorder on the target system. Mm-hmm. So it'll record all the register state, all the memory state, keep that in a great big file, and then it'll have a playback set up. They have I think they're hooking onto Eclipse like everyone is nowadays. I guess we talked about DDD, but there also are GDB front ends in Eclipse as well. Mm-hmm. But it hooks into Eclipse and then you can play back your debugging session. And that's really handy for embedded work and it's extremely handy for whenever you have race type conditions you need to check out. Because one of the things about GDB that's, I wouldn't call it unfortunate, but just the nature of the architecture is that it, even though it can debug something running multiple threads, it isn't what you would describe as being a multi-threaded debugger, right? Because any breakpoint will stop all the other threads from running.
Right, it will suspend all the threads.
Yeah, and I don't mean to, it's not, my point is not to ding GDB, which I said is by all means excellent software, but that is a limitation that you run into. Mm-hmm. And something like a tool that just does a recording would do a much better job of letting you see what threads are running and just keep track of what's going on.
A nice complement to GDB to basically provide that additional level of debugging, right?
Yeah.
Because as you said, it can be used in an environment or scenario where you want to have all the other tasks or threads executing in a system while you watch execution on a specific thread.
Yeah. As like anything else, it's interesting. Mm-hmm. The reason why multi-threaded work is so hard, right? And the reason why, in order to do it well, you either need to have years of practice, mm-hmm. or years of practice. One of those two things. is that you really have to be able to keep running in your mind all the other threads that happen to be running. So it would be something like a tool like Chronicle would be really great, because then you could run one thread, at least grok what's happening, and then step to the other thread or the two other threads you think are trouble causers, right?
Right.
Of course, because it's not your code that's wrong, right? The threads misbehave. You know how that works. So you could step through and at least see what's going on there and keep things running in your mind. I think it'd be a great help out there, because that is a deficit to GDB with its current architecture, and that you can debug multiple threads, but any stop, any pause pauses all threads from running.
Right.
So you can either create or suppress some interesting race conditions that some other tools would be better at helping you find.
So we talked primarily, I guess, so far about debugging an application, right? Because GDB server can help you out with only application debugging.
Well, yeah. Before we leave the topic,
it was your topic.
In my minutes of preparation, but there's one thing I didn't want to mention. That is, for as great GDB server is for remote debugging, my first recommendation is don't use it for debugging your application. There, for the greatest part, a lot of the application code that's out there is not, target specific,
architecture specific.
There's no reason why you can't compile it and write some scaffolding code, mm-hmm. and have some debug cases built up around your code so that you don't have to debug it remotely.
Well, but then I guess you would have to build your own test framework on a host for hardware specific functions.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes. But not always, right? I mean, there are certain hardware-specific functions that you can still separate your. I mean, if you're running code that, counts a loop, mm-hmm. That processes some data that creates who knows what, some network traffic, you could probably stub the hardware part out. But even for a lot of Linux systems, if you have something that's monitoring a network line, you don't have to emulate it. You can still put on your PC the same rough equivalent. And let's say you can get perfect, because you're still going to have to do debugging on the target, but there's a lot of code that you can get away with debugging right on your host. And that's probably the most efficient route.
That's a very good point, because if the API that your application is exercising is also present on your host machine, there's no difference.
Yeah.
And it's that much faster, right? Because usually your host is like, 3 gigahertz Pentium these days, or dual or quad core processor.
Oh, yeah.
So the speed with which you would develop and debug that application is much greater than executing it on 500 megahertz.
Target. Well, what it does too is it shortens the loop, right? There's an edit, compile, debug loop, right? That happens, and then no matter how good that target machine is, you still have to get the code on the target machine and begin that session, and then begin your editing, and then step through the problem, the cause of the problem. And whenever you work remotely, you're running over a serial protocol that is on a slower machine, and you're going to pay for that. And you want to keep your head in your head in what you're doing, and that's break at least for someone like me. So 3 second attention span. That's really important.
I agree with you and disagree to some degree.
Yeah.
Because when you work with a target platform, first you don't have to develop that additional layer. If your application for some reason is attached to a target specific hardware, right?
Yeah.
And there are tools right now on the market that hide those complexities of cross environment from you, so that loop of coding, compiling, trying, or debugging on a target is much faster right now to execute.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, if you have a very large application that takes a lot of time to initialize on a target, and every single time you have to load it entirely on a target, and by any means, it makes more sense to execute it on a host.
Yeah. And plus, the QA guys like the idea that you have some test harnesses built up, right?
That's true.
But QA
would always look at the target, not at the host.
Yeah, and they'd always complain too. No matter what you do, it wouldn't be right.
Yeah. So we talked about applications. So now let's switch to a topic that you wanted to spend some time on as well.
Which I think we have 4.1 minutes for that.
Are you already flagged?
Yeah. We'll keep going.
All right. So kernel debugging.
Yeah.
In the past, one of the most popular open source approaches to debugging a kernel, and actually very, very, very popular even these days is called PrintK.
Well, you know, not only is it popular, but it's effective.
It's right? Very effective. And it's very simple. You just put additional print case across the kernel code, and that way you can take a look at various variables, and you're not troubled by multi-threaded or anything.
Infinite flexibility with respect to how things are printed. You know, complete flexibility with respect to where your information is, where you can gather information.
Depending on where you put that print key, be prepared to analyze tens of pages of output.
Yeah. Well, that's great as well, too, right?
Yeah.
All the information at your fingertips.
Better than that. Yeah. So, but there's in the past, from a high level, Linux kernel debugging standpoint, there was a part of a Linux kernel code called kernel GNU debugger, KGDB, I guess.
Yeah, KGDB.
Which has been used in across environments, meaning once KGDB is built and enabled in the Linux kernel, it was connecting back to a GDB on a host machine, exposing the same set of data, same kind of information as GDB server does from the application standpoint.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add that allowing this way customers to peek into the Linux kernel execution. Mm-hmm. There are, again, some pitfalls, saying that we've mentioned for application, which is you suspend one thread, all threads, and the system stop, which might be troublesome, and in some scenarios can cause the kernel to be fairly unstable.
Yeah.
Because of those timings, which are very frequently very important to how the operating system executes on the target.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the other thing too is, and until recently, and it's, I know it's not widely supported, is KGDB only ran over serial, which makes a lot of sense if you think about the amount of work it takes to set up a TCP connection, right? I mean, that makes perfect sense compared to a serial connection. And a lot of it was the fact that the infrastructure in the kernel for an early serial connection was already there, right? And you sort of hooked onto that infrastructure. But I know recently but not for architectures, debugging over the Ethernet port has been introduced.
Yep.
So that, I mean, that speeds up some of the debugging. Mm-hmm. And then I guess in terms of limitations too, is you're limited to code that occurs after kernel start, right?
Right.
So and I guess
exactly.
Start is the kernel entry point, right? It's the main, I'm making quotes with my fingers here, it's the main function of the kernel.
So if something happens in that early stages of kernel initialization, you're not going to be able to pick it up with KGDB.
That's correct.
The problem about KGDB, though, these days, is that it seems like the project has been abandoned. Although there are some recent posts on the KGDB site suggesting that there is some new development going on. But as far as I know, the active support or active development that I'm aware of has stopped with 2.6.18 kernel, if I'm not mistaken.
But that project has always run in fits and starts, right? Yeah. It seems like there's a year lull and then a huge amount of activity and then a lull and then a lot of activity. So, yeah, so it must be in one of those lulls again.
Well, I think that part of a reason why it wasn't so popular was that, again, engineers that do Linux kernel development, they do prefer to use a print case.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Right? It's so handy. It's already implemented in the Linux kernel. All you have to do is insert it in specific parts that interest you the most, your device driver, perhaps.
Yep.
And rebuild the kernel.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is, I mean, so debugging, like, even though it's a lot easier now with debugging something like a kernel module, because the kernel module, in essence, is relocated code, right? The code starts up and the kernel figures out where it goes in memory and does, you know, symbol fix-ups and everything else. Debugging that with something like GDB was difficult, right? Was difficult. And PrintK is actually a lot easier with respect to the, you know, what you need to do to instrument your code. And that's easy, right? You just do a search for print K and knock them all out when you're ready to
get ready. That combined with other mechanisms that are really available today in the Linux kernel under kernel hacking options, make it a very self-aware operating system.
Yeah.
You can debug shared IRQ handlers. So if you write a device driver that is hooked onto one of those shared lines, you want to make sure that the device driver knows how to handle interrupts coming from other sources, interrupts that are not intended for your device driver, but because you're on a shared line, you have to somehow handle it. So there is that option in the Linux kernel. There are options in the Linux kernel that help you track semantic violations for real-time and just standard mutexes.
Oh, wow.
So when you enable that and your code violates some of those semantics, and it will be flagged out right away. There are options to debug spin locks. If you have an SMP machine, it's fairly easy to then pinpoint which spin locks have not been initialized or, again, semantics violations for some of the spin locks. I have a short cheat list here that I'm going through. So
it's all from memory.
Just wanted to make that clear. There's also an option to debug spin lock sleep, which means that if you have a part of a code that tries to sleep while any spin lock is being held, that's very bad from execution.
You'd really like to have that for user land, right? Because that's a famous stunt.
Useful, yeah.
Well, it's a famous stunt of mine, at least, in terms of stuff I've screwed up.
That's how you do the latency trick, right? I mean... If you sleep while holding any of a mutual exclusion, that's very bad, right?
That's how you fix timing problems. What are you talking about? that's worked for me. I don't know how many times. Of course, it bombs when it goes out in the field. That's someone else's problem, right?
Exactly. And there's also another area of the Linux kernel where you can do early debugging, which is precisely what you were talking about, the early initialization code that happens in the Linux kernel. Mm-hmm. You can enable some of the debug output
early
area. Yeah. It can be dangerous though, because depending on what you've changed in that area, that might make your kernel unusable and fairly difficult to track what the problem is. But then there's another debugging possibility here, right? Which is a hardware assisted debugging.
Oh yeah. The classic, the JTAG debugger.
The JTAG debugger,
We get a lot of people that, and it's interesting that they'll come and say, well, I'm doing kernel debugging, therefore I need a JTAG. And this is, I don't know, but these are people that are, I guess, fairly new, but they believe that that's necessary for kernel debugging. And it takes a while for us to really tell them what a JTAG debugger is good for them to get their head around it. Because a JTAG, well, JTAG is a, geez, I think it's a joint test action group, right?
So you're good. All those.
Yeah, well, no, I don't like to use acronyms unless I can unpack them, right? So, and that's out of, I think it's a standard out of like 85 or something. Is you know, the first chip that did that, I think, was a 486.
Oh,
80486
wow.
was the first,
good 486.
It was the first thing that did JTAG. And I mean, what it was there for, I mean, JTAG was a, what they called a boundary scan protocol. Mm-hmm. So it was there so that you could plug something in and say, do I have continuity? Mm-hmm. Across my circuits, or you know, do I have an open loop?
At a hardware level.
Yeah, it's basically for electrical problem, right? To make sure that the board was wired up correctly, and they snuck in, right? The software guy showed up and ruined a perfectly good system by introducing some boundary scan logic, and even like they have a boundary scan descriptor language that'll report the pieces and that are happen to be on the chain and everything, so you can really get a really good picture of the system through this JTAG protocol.
Yeah. So it's very easy to attach a software probe and take a look at different states of various hardware components. And today, almost all JTAGs that I know, they are GDB aware. So you can use the same interface to talk to JTAG hardware and take a look at the same information, registers, memory, state of different, not variables, but you can really navigate through the code on the target using hardware probe.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing, and where you got the other flag from the saying we're way over, so it's but who cares? So the other thing that's it's just too bad, right? So the other thing, because this is important stuff, I think. But I guess the other thing that's important about, about JTAG is that it's still a protocol like saying serial, right? This is the first thing. It's serial, and usually it works with like a small ICE device, right? Mm-hmm. And which is a in-circuit emulator, right? That's that's ICE. And so what something like that does is it really emulates the hardware. And it's not like the ICE. It's not like ICE debuggers from like 1980 or whatever. Right. I mean, these things, usually the microcontroller has a lot of the software on it, has a little bit of a module on it. So really the device, the in-circuit emulator you get, really just manages the debugging stuff on the target, right? Yeah,
so there's like a firmware embedded on the EEPROM that emulates.
Yeah. So it's not quite like the ICE of days before where you'd actually get this big computer that had, you remember that had like the die for the computer, you just plug it in and it in software emulated the chip, but it's not like that anymore. But the more important thing to mention about those sort of hardware debuggers is that
they're designed to run without address translation, right? So once the memory management starts up, they lose a lot of their utility.
Right.
And even though you can't force them to be somewhat aware. And you know, the interesting thing is once you support hardware debugging, it doesn't really matter at that point what it's debugging. I mean, it knows the symbol table and really can debug anything that happens that it knows where it is in memory because you're talking right to the hardware. And like GDB, server, KGDB, that's, it sort of gets in there on a software level, right?
Yeah.
See what's going on.
Right. So with KGDB or GDB on the target, all you can do is look at this state. The assumption is that the system is still in a working order.
Yes.
It's stable, that it can transmit the data.
Yes.
The minute it goes down, you're doomed. The only way
do
is try to backpedal a bit and put the print KB before crashes, before the doom, hoping that that's the right place, right?
Yeah.
It's, again, going back to what we talked about earlier, finding that end of a loop where you can put the breakpoint and this is my print K, let's check it. With JTAG, you can just simply take a look at the state of registers when the crash occurs.
Yes.
They are very useful to debug bootloaders. So if you write the code that initializes your card, or you're adjusting an open source bootloader, JTAG comes in very handy.
Yeah.
But you do it usually once per project, completely at the beginning, and then you move to a software assisted debugging more than hardware assisted.
And for the most part, once you get the kernel started, there's all that architecture specific startup code. You're probably better off with printk at that point. And by no means I'm just discrediting, because the JTAG these hardware debuggers, they are the perfect tools, right?
Yeah.
They're fantastic tools, but they're not general purpose debugging tools. And that's the...
If you have one handy and you don't mind setting it up for your system and you don't have to move the system or share the system with other developers, then absolutely keep it this way, and you'll get the return for the money that you've paid for the
debugger. I guess I think when I began this little webinar series, it's the right tool for a certain job, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the right tool for any debugging job. So I think that's what we wanted to cover. I have a few other things, but I think it was
we reached the point of 40 minutes, which is very unusual for our podcast. So apologize for if we consume more of your time than usual.
Yeah, I am. So the other thing too is this weekend we're heading out to the Ontario Linux Fest.
Oh yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun.
As you call it, the Oktoberfest. Right?
There you go.
Somehow Linux in Ontario sort of got cropped.
Well, we're going to take our microphones and, of course, all the systems that we have here in our little studio, and we'll try to record a few interviews and podcasts.
Yeah. Well, they have some great some great people speaking there, and so I'd love to get some of the speakers, and I'd love to get some of the folks in that are attending, because there's a huge amount of Linux activity in Ontario, and there's a lot of embedded activity happening. There's a lot of process control folks and a lot of embedded work there. So
if you're at Ontario Linux Fest, please try to look for us. We'll be somewhere over there. We don't know exactly where our little studio will be located, but we'll make sure that somehow we're visible.
Yeah, and if you're in Toronto and you have
Ontario, you mean.
Toronto's in Ontario.
Oh, okay.
Is it?
Yeah,
that's what I've been told.
You're right.
I know
it's in Toronto, Ontario.
I know I'm an American, right? And so I have no idea what's slightly north of the line. But I'm pretty certain Toronto's right there in Ontario. But so. But if you're in the Toronto, because I know it's in the, I think it's in the Congress Center outside of Toronto, stop by, right? If you feel like geeking around. If you look at it and talk to the organizer and whatever else, it's like a fantastic way to, geek out for Saturday.
Yep. If you have any comments, suggestions, we would like to hear from you. Please send those to podcast@timesys.com. We have received quite a few of comments last time.
Oh yeah.
Because we've run over time today, we just didn't address some of the questions we got.
But I still have
we'll address those next time.
Yeah, it's a podcast@timesys.com. We get a lot of mail and we try to answer. If you write to us, we really try to answer you, but we get a lot of mail, which I find incredible, right? That a lot of people write in and we don't get to respond to all of it. The hate mail we definitely respond to, by the way. Anything, feel free to write in podcast@timesys.com. Just we'd love to hear from you.
Great, thanks a lot.
And see you in the next 2 weeks.
This podcast was brought to you by TimeSys. Are you new to embedded Linux? Looking for a way to simplify your next project? The Linux Link service by TimeSys makes it easy to build your custom embedded Linux platform. go to timesys.com today or call 866-392-4897 to learn more.